You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the future of e-commerce. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Tabea Soriano, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Tabea, you're in New York right now. What are you up to these days? You're the managing partner at FutureMade. Tell me a little bit about FutureMade.
So I moved back to New York in November. We, as FutureMade, actually have a lot of clients out here, and that was kind of one of the reasons I came out here. But we're a sustainability strategy consulting company or agency, or maybe even more of a consortium of three consultants. I'm here in New York. Jeff is in Park City, and James, my other business partner, is in San Francisco. And basically what we do is advise on sustainability efforts for mostly apparel and equipment companies. And that can mean so many things to so many different kinds of businesses. But essentially, we're kind of here to give companies a lay of the land of this thing called sustainability, which for us includes, you know, social compliance, environmental compliance and impact, and then also kind of corporate social responsibility efforts and culture, kind of what falls under the B Corporation assessment.
So before this, you were the head of product at Reformation for 3 years. Was that one of the things that inspired you to go down this path, or what made you decide to start FutureMade?
Yeah. So FutureMade came about as kind of, you know, us as professionals within brands, for Jeff and me, and then for James, having been the managing partner at an auditing company, a social compliance auditing company. And for me personally, I just wanted to get a little bit more into the weeds of the sustainability part and really kind of learn from my two business partners, because they are very vertical in what they do. And for me at Reformation, I have a lot of product background, and that's kind of, you know, that my decade of experience before FutureMade was in product and supply chain, more on the brand side. I think I wanted to get a little bit deeper and see what else is out there, because it is such a big, vast field. And, you know, when you're making clothes and you're kind of on the product side, the scope is definitely already there and set up, but you're not really getting into the strategy part of it. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about that and actually start implementing strategies for other companies.
So what kind of companies do you usually work with? Are they mostly startups or big companies or everything?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're actually finding, so we went in thinking, all right, you know, we'll probably be advising startups, right? Because it is, objectively speaking, easier to kind of implement sustainability from the ground up rather than retrofitting. That's not to say that one shouldn't retrofit, obviously. But what happened was, actually, we garnered a lot of attention from the really big companies, the big apparel companies, mall brands that, you know, you and I know. And so we did that. Like last year, we had a couple of clients, as I said, mostly in New York. And for them, it was kind of straight up strategy work, where, you know, you kind of do the working with the C-level from the top down, and then from the bottom up, kind of doing some of the industry tools and assessments to kind of see where a company lies on the spectrum of sustainability, and then laying out, you know, a path forward. That being said, on the other end of the spectrum, there are also startups that we work with, specifically that I work with, because that's my background. And their sustainability is a little bit less strategic. It's more just kind of implemented, you know, where I will mostly, and Jeff actually does this too, we'll kind of work on the product development and production side. And as we're doing the thing that we've been doing for decades already, which is products, we'll you know, incorporate sustainability there as it comes. So it's kind of both and everything in between, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. Before I started Lumi, I was studying as an industrial designer, but before that, I actually got a degree in biology. And so I've always had, you know, a fascination for sustainability. And one of the reasons that we started Lumi was also, you know, what can we do in the world of packaging to make the supply chain
100%.
A lot more efficient, yeah. a lot more sustainable. But one of the things that I think we struggle with all the time at Lumi is that there's a really challenging communication problem around sustainability, because the real solutions are really complex. Like the real right. solutions involve, you know, looking at your manufacturing practices and processes, your materials, the way you're shipping, the recycled, you know, the whole life cycle of the product and the company as a whole. But the the marketable solutions are the ones that are really simple. Like the ones that you can say in one sentence are the ones that get people attention.
It's
and
so true.
And it's, how do you deal with that? Like, how do you even begin to, when you're talking to someone, a startup that comes knocking on your door and they say like, we want to make our company more sustainable. How do you deal with that paradox?
Yeah, that's a great question, because what we have seen is that, you know, if it's a startup, it's usually the founder, but if it's a big company, it's usually the marketing head that will come to us, because, you know, this is for the big guys, it's a story. For the small guys, maybe they're inherently interested, but they're also trying to build a business by the same stroke. So for us, and this is kind of our approach, you know, the first thing that we say is, look, like it needs to be kind of horizontal across all verticals. Typically, or in the past, sustainability or CSR, corporate social responsibility, has lived under the legal team. And that's slowly starting to shift, especially as marketing becomes interested in it. I think we're pretty kind of blunt about not being able to tell a story that isn't there, obviously. But what we do say is, you know, let's get to compliance on XYZ thing. Like, let's do the baseline across the board. That's that kind of that horizontal across all verticals. And then help you as a brand pick one or two kind of things that you actually want to either optimize, which I guess we would call the level up, you know, above compliance, or even innovate on, you know, if there are funds or if there's the manpower to kind of do that. And that just becomes a little bit more manageable, I think, because as you said, it is so vast. Sustainability is such, you know, you move one lever over here and it moves 15 other levers down the line, especially when you're talking about a supply chain and the entire life cycle of a product and all the things that go into it, all the human components and all the environmental components and the impact that it has on both of those things. So yeah, it's honestly, it's a frank conversation to begin with, but also being pretty rooted in kind of a business mindset. Like, you can't do everything at 100%. I mean, Patagonia is doing that, but, you know, that's what they do, but that's also ingrained in their 50-year DNA as a brand. So, yeah, it's kind of going vertical or going horizontal across the verticals and then choosing one or two things to kind of excel or become known for, if that's within your brand identity. And if it's not, it's just being compliant.
Do you find that people, when they come to you, are realistic about that, or do they have? Does it take a little bit of time to work with them to get to that point?
It does take a little bit of time, especially if it's, you know, if it's a marketing team effort where, if someone wants a story, they want the story. And it's not simply, you know, coming up with the design of the story, right? Because you're really needing to implement changes sometimes overseas, you know, if you're producing overseas, and all of that stuff takes time. So yeah, it can take time to kind of get to that point with the brands too. But I think it's partially business strategy, because it's not just a short-term, quick, like, solution that you can just kind of set and leave. A lot of this, you know, even now, brands, especially the big guys, you know, we're not even looking at 2020 anymore. We're looking at 2030 goals for a lot of bigger brands and companies. So I would say it takes a little bit of time, but I also think brands know the importance of, you know, integrating this long term and actually seeing that it is something that isn't, yeah, just a story, or it can't be just a story, really.
I think your point about, you know, the marketing side of companies coming to you I didn't expect that, but it actually does make a lot of sense and meshes up well with what you see out there, because probably something that gets the most attention in sustainability is whenever a big brand does something with materials. Like they're trying to do something with a new recycled material or a new more environmentally friendly material. That is like the most high level thing, the most visible thing, because it's the thing that a customer can actually touch and see because they have received the product. Do you get a lot of those kinds of requests, or are you guys able to make some deeper supply chain changes or things like that?
Actually, we are able to make deeper supply chain changes. Well, we at least do the strategy for that. We haven't done the implementation work at that scale yet, but strategy work is usually based on some industry tools that are out there that, you know, necessitate kind of, especially corporations that are members of, for example, the Sustainable Apparel Coalition, and their tool, the HIG Index, which is, you know, this very in-depth supply chain tool that benchmarks you as a big company kind of against other apparel companies, you know, across different things, waste, supply chain.
I wasn't familiar
CO2.
With that one.
Yeah, it's very industry specific, but because it exists and because it is, you know, kind of, it is a benchmarking apparatus, there are ways to implement changes and there are, you know, paths forward to implement changes kind of in the unsexy bits of the company that aren't even necessarily consumer facing and probably wouldn't even be marketable in any real way. So that's kind of, I think we're, you know, sometimes we get confused with a branding firm. We're not branding people. We're deep supply chain people. And where I think the conversation is going to go for FutureMate is actually aligning with branding firms so that we are, you know, maybe consultants that go hand in hand with brand strategy firms. And this becomes like, you know, a brand strategy and a sustainability strategy kind of almost becomes like a business strategy for a company.
Yeah, I was just looking up the HIG index. It's HIGG. We'll put a link in the show notes. Who do you think, aside from Patagonia, does a really good job with this?
That's a great question. Patagonia and, you know, on the other end of the spectrum and on the other side of the country is Eileen Fisher. They're a women's wear brand, older demographic. They do a lot of similar work that Patagonia does in terms of looking at the life cycle of a garment kind of holistically. They're two of the only brands like that, you know, where they'll repair garments no matter if they're from their brands or not, and or, you know, kind of do the consumer education around, you know, mending a garment, washing it, all that kind of stuff, and also looking upstream the supply chain into like chemical inputs and the people making the clothing and who made the fabrics and that kind of thing. There are other smaller brands that focus maybe on Made in USA, or they focus on, you know, a specific fabric that they can trace, focus on living wage. So holistically, I would say those are the two, you know, main guys doing a great job. That being said, they're also both private. So they aren't necessarily beholden to their shareholders and can kind of invest that money. They also both happen to be B corporations. Those two are my quick answers. And then there's, you know, so much to be said about a lot of other brands and their path of continuous improvement. I would say that that's where most companies are. And even Eileen Fisher and Patagonia say they're on the path of continuous improvement. But it's just kind of incrementally getting better year over year. And that usually requires also, or doesn't usually, it does require tracking a lot of the unsexy bits again. Yeah.
One of the things that comes up all the time that I wonder how much this affects, you know, the conversations that you're having is oftentimes sustainability actually improves your costs. Like if you make certain kinds of choices, you can actually lower your costs. And that's something where I think it's a big misconception in a lot of industries that that's always going to cost you more. Is that something that you guys talk about or work with companies on?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a question that we get a lot. And it's really hard to make a blanket statement about that. I think the fact of the matter is that you kind of have to look at each thing that you're doing, each sustainability effort individually to kind of figure out if that is true or not true. I can say, for example, you know, one of the big things in materials is generic cotton versus a better cotton. And there are a few ways, to have a quote unquote better cotton. One of them is BCI cotton, which is literally the acronym for Better Cotton Initiative. Another is organic cotton. And then there's cotton made in Africa. Organic cotton in terms of supply will never, or where we are now, not be able to meet the global demand for cotton. So, you know, organic cotton kind of sits on its own on one end right now at this moment in time. But BCI, the Better Cotton Initiative, that per yard cost is negligible for most companies. So I wouldn't say it's better for the bottom line, but it's definitely not worse. That on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, there are studies that have been done by some of the bigger consulting firms in terms of sustainability efforts, kind of the pricing tolerance from customers. You know, it varies from like 15 to 30% price increase. And I guess there could be I haven't read this yet, but there are kind of those notions that you have a different customer base and you have a more loyal customer base because you are paying attention to these things. So I'm kind of a realist. So I want to say that it could be more cost effective. I don't know that it is in the immediate short term.
Long
term.
I think in our case at Limi, at least, we've found that if we can pair those two things together, like a cost reduction and an increase in sustainability, that it really becomes a no-brainer for a lot of brands.
Right.
And there's like a couple big areas where, you know, we've pushed towards that. And probably the biggest one is in our corrugate supply chain. We're now producing in hundreds, if not thousands, of different factories across the world. And we try to be as localized as possible so that the emissions moving the packaging from where it's manufactured to where it's going to be used is as small as possible. And that's a win-win because it's, you know, obviously if you're packaging is, this is very packaging specific, but packaging is quite heavy, but it's also very cheap. So when you're moving it around in freight trucks, the further you go with that in your container trucks, the more it costs.
Right.
So it turns out to align itself quite well. And that's been a really easy, like no-brainer choice for a lot of our customers to make the switch to using like much more local production.
And packaging is actually a great example, kind of, you know, to your original question, at scale too. We had this was like an anecdotal conversation about a different brand with a brand that we had last year about a shirting company, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, kind of changing the packaging of around their shirts, how it was shipped from overseas to the US. And, you know, they got rid of one cardboard collar stay and this plastic thing or whatever, and one of the paper, you know, one of the tissue paper things, and maybe went from you know, individual poly bags to bulk poly bags, bulk poly bags being the liner that's around the whole carton rather than just one poly bag per shirt. And that was a waste reduction measurement. Secondarily, primarily, it was a cost reduction measurement. Exactly as you say, those packaging is actually a great place to start, both in terms of impact and cost reduction, like the win-win.
When you look at, I mean, you're very specialized or have a lot of experience in the apparel industry in particular. When you order online from e-commerce businesses, it must be somewhat obvious which ones are paying attention to this and which ones aren't. Are there things that you're noticing that you wish some companies weren't doing that would be like an easy win?
So there's two answers there, I think, for me. Like me as a consumer, the packaging thing kills me. I think there's a lot of it. And I understand the kind of the the user experience of packaging. I think it is important. And I do think we create emotional connections, especially for e-commerce brands where you don't necessarily have that store experience. You have the experience when, you know, on the site, obviously, and then when you open up, you know, the packaging. I love the Net-a-Porter option of packaging. You know, they have their kind of iconic black box, but then at checkout, you can also kind of just opt for the basic craft box. I think giving consumers a little bit more autonomy to decide that. And to be honest, you know, having just moved back to New York, we were kind of buying furniture and all this stuff. You know, Amazon was a big player. You know, grouping shipments, just getting a little bit smarter about that final mile and the logistics of it. The building that I moved into is new. There's 60 units. Like, the trash piles were insane. Something about that. I don't actually think that this is a conversation for a startup even. Like, I think it's just a bigger conversation of what happens with that stuff after we use it. Me as a consultant, if a startup is asking, like, what can we do right now? It's hard because a startup is building a business and they're trying to, you know, get customers and optimize their product and do all of this other stuff. I think the best advice, you know, for a startup, if they are interested in sustainability, you know, generally, but it's not necessarily part of their brand DNA, is planning for it in a way that's, you know, you don't have to deal with it every day. You might not even have to deal with it every week, but kind of having like an internal committee that, you know, makes it a priority to at least meet once a month or however much that cadence is, whenever you can fit it in as you're trying to grow this business, and just setting incremental goals. And I actually find that the B impact assessment, that's that tool by the B Corporation folks, is a good guidance mechanism to do that. And so that can be as little or as much or however, you know, whatever you are able to do in your first and second years. Well, again, like while you're starting to build a business and having come kind of from that startup background and even now advising startups, that still comes first. You know, in sustainability, we talk a lot about the triple bottom line, which is people, planet, and profit. And for a lot of companies who have sustainability at their core DNA, you know, let's say people or planet, sometimes profit kind of loses out. And I'm not saying profit as in the money that you're making, but actually becoming a viable business.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great point.
You know what I mean? So I think kind of keeping a 360 look out for your new thing and allowing the time for this thing called sustainability, you know, put it on the calendar, but also don't get too caught up in it in those first years.
That's a very pragmatic answer. I like that. Yeah. I think that's definitely true. You know, it's easy to be very idealistic, but if your company doesn't survive, then, you know, what are you?
If you don't have a company, there's no sustainability impact.
Right. So another thing that, you know, people might not be familiar with, like life cycle analysis as a field in general. Is that an area that you guys do full life cycle studies, or is that something that you leave to like?
No.
Because that's a very deep challenge as well. Can you explain what that is and how you advise people who may want to do that?
So there are companies that do this. We haven't actually ever needed to hire one for any of our current or past clients yet. But basically, it's kind of tracking metrics, usually, you know, CO2 emissions, maybe wastewater, basically environmental metrics, could also actually be sustainability metrics like social impact, which gets even hazier because, you know, it's less kind of tracking numbers. It's actually going in on the ground. But anyway, you're looking at these metrics from literally the extraction of the raw material, whatever that may be. If it's cotton, it's the plant. If it's polyester, it's the petroleum. All the way through, you know, fiber. So fiber extraction to materials through whatever the process is that you're manufacturing with. So if that's cut and sew, or if it's knitting or whatever it is, through logistics and distribution, to warehousing, to the sale, to, you know, the customer use phase, and then all the way to the end of life or end of use, which is basically donating and or trashing and or recycling, whatever that downstream is. So you're following this product the entire way. And these things go really in depth. And I actually was just talking to my business partner, Jeff, about it last week. You know, we're looking at like months of work around this, for even just one product, let alone an entire, like, let's say supply chain for a company. So yeah, we don't actually do that work. There are, specialists that do that. Very intense work.
Do you guys ever recommend it? So when companies come to you, maybe they've done that before, or they're approaching it from a different angle, or they're not, that's not what they're looking for.
For a lot of companies, because they're so at the beginning of this journey, it's beyond the scope.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also not cheap. You know, it's months worth of work, and it's consulting work, and it's not necessarily the most cost effective, especially for sustainability, where, to be honest, the budgets are still small within companies. So for the clients that we've had so far, I would say it's beyond the scope of what they're doing right now. And of all the things that they might want to tackle, that kind of goes to the bottom rung for now. There are kind of like maybe quick fix band-aid solutions of getting an over under of impact, you know, kind of using the Hague. The Sustainable Apparel Coalition also has this thing called the MSI, the Material Sustainability Index, which is basically tracks most of the environmental impact from raw material extraction to gate. So that is called cradle to gate, basically when the raw material is ready to be turned into a fabric. So that obviously doesn't capture, you know, manufacturing and purchase and all that kind of stuff. But you can get that beginning part and then maybe have some kind of, you know, CO2 emission over under metrics capture through another tool. Or maybe there's like some kind of online, you know, over under numbers. Again, that's not an exact science, and I would not recommend that as an alternative to an LCA. But if an LCA isn't in the budget, some people kind of clobber together the information.
Yeah, I sort of did a mini version of that when I was going through industrial design school. It was to study, to do kind of a basic LCA myself of a leather wallet. And I, you know, it was tracking all the different, because leather in particular has some challenging manufacturing yep. problems associated with it. I think if you're someone who knows a little bit about LCA, it's an opportunity to find new innovative products that avoid entire processes in the life cycle.
Totally.
To me, it's an interesting opportunity for like ideating around a new business. Like, what pieces of this life cycle could you take out or yep. add to make the whole thing much more efficient or more sustainable?
And I think if you want to approach like your product like that, it's even just going through the mental exercise of, okay, where did this thing come from and where is it going? Like just even kind of mapping out, if it's on the, you know, on a napkin, mapping out kind of the entire, you know, life cycle and thereby supply chain of this thing that's in front of you. I think that's a good place to start.
Yeah. I mean, in the case of this like leather wallet, for instance, I'm not going to go too in depth with it, but if you haven't seen what a life cycle chart, in the end, you try to make it a nice chart that shows all the, like, it's like a big table that shows all the steps. And some of the biggest gains are just like being able to remove a whole chunk of that,
right?
Of the processing that goes on. And that's what, for example, me and Jesse, my co-founder, went through Y Combinator. We never had like those types of conversations, but we could have. Like that's a type of conversation at the very initiation of a new business or of a new product line that to me rarely happens, but, or from what I can tell, rarely happens, but is actually an opportunity to like invent something. That's where innovation can happen.
Definitely. I agree.
So I know that you can't share a lot of names around your clients, but can you maybe describe some of the projects that you've been really proud of in the past few years that you've contributed to, just without naming any names?
Yeah. They've all been very different. One was, kind of what we mentioned earlier, kind of the strategy work from, you know, top down, bottom up approach, where you're brainstorming with C-level people on, you know, what they as a company want to innovate on and, you know, what they want to own, kind of with the understanding that we have to get to compliance across the board, but, you know, what they want to own as a brand. Seeing the outcome of that kind of in real life has been great. So, you know, one of those was using waste as kind of the thing that they're going to innovate on, and following from a distance, you know, the solutions that have kind of been implemented in their retail stores. There was another one. I guess it's kind of a nerdy thing, but I built this Excel spreadsheet that kind of was using different levers to put values on. Wow, this is, I'm saying this out loud and I sound like a nerd. Put values on the code of conduct. So the code of conduct is basically like the contract that you have with a manufacturing facility that evolves around human rights, basically. I mean, at this point, it says no child labor, freedom of speech, you know, freedom from harassment and abuse. And it's usually, you know, 12 to 15 kind of provisions that a company would have with a manufacturing facility. And just, it was a lever system. It was an Excel spreadsheet lever system of getting away from, you know, oh, if one of these is violated, then you're out. That's kind of an old school way of doing business. Unless it's of course one of the zero tolerance provisions, which would be child labor or forced labor, slavery. But all the other ones, like giving those provisions nuances, and yeah, it was an Excel spreadsheet to kind of help the supply chain people of that brand to kind of like get a better handle on what they were actually dealing with through audits.
Yeah, I've been thinking about developing a scoring system for packaging at Limi. And we sort of know what the variables are, and we're talking to our customers a lot about it, because the choices are, there's so many weird trade-offs, because
definitely
the obvious things that you look at are, okay, how recyclable is this material? Is it made out of recycled materials or post-consumer materials? But then there are harder things to measure. Like, for example, a corrugate box is heavier than a poly mailer.
Right.
And so shipping those around, you know, from the factory to your distribution center and then from the distribution center to all the people might increase the overall carbon footprint more than a material that maybe is less recyclable, but also way less heavy and space saving. So like those types of measurements are so hard for people to wrap their head around.
Yep.
that we're trying to like simplify it the best that we can.
Yeah. Did you guys have a quick fix solution?
Well, no, that's the problem. That's where we're trying to work towards some sort of scoring system that helps people assess things on what this packaging material on the surface looks like. But then you have to really take into account how it's being used in order to get the full picture.
Yep, 100%. I'm with you.
What are the things that you're like reading every day that inform your approach to this, or the recommendations that you make? Because it's such an evolving field. I feel like
it is.
I'm always trying to find better sources of, you know, ideas and knowledge and studies around this.
Yeah. So, you know, I have like a feed that kind of picks up on some keywords and I'll get headlines through that. But, you know, a lot of this has become mainstream. Like sustainability has become, you know, not mainstream as, you know, as a news story, but it's, you know, business of fashion has a lot of sustainability headlines. So I'll read those. There's a really good newsletter that I don't even know how I found, but it's called Retail Dive, D-I-V-E. And they have an affiliate called Supply Chain Dive. And there's some really good info there. So they talk a lot about kind of the industry at large, which includes kind of sustainability and also includes kind of the end of retail as we know it and that kind of thing. The big topic, and Patagonia just had, you know, inboxed me or us this past week is about microplastics. That's kind of the big one right now. So microplastics being not the continent of plastic in the ocean, which is also a real thing, but actually the tiny plastic particles that aren't really visible to the human eye, and how those have effectively already entered our food chain. It's that continent of plastic breaking down into tiny, tiny bits, and then the fish eating it and, you know, working its way all the way back to kind of our consumption through water and through food. You know, there are different industries that contribute to that, but one of the big ones is textiles. And a lot of it has to do with washing your synthetics in the washer dryer. So it's kind of the thing of the moment. But of course, there are a lot of things of the moment because, you know, a lot of these issues are kind of long-term. They've been germinating for a while, and they're going to take a while to figure out too.
Yeah. You mentioned the death of retail. What's your take on that in terms of sustainability, the move to direct to consumer? It seems like it's still sort of unclear, you know, what the environmental impact of that is compared to, you know, people driving to the mall, for example. Have you guys studied that much? Is that an area that you're thinking about?
Me personally, I'm very interested in kind of the entire business of retail. Yeah, I don't know that we necessarily know exactly how this is all going to shake out. I think we're really in flux right now with, you know, leases in big brick and mortar malls and, you know, even in shopping areas that we, you know, all used to go to. That's on the one end of the conversation. Like, what does that mean? But then also the rise in e-commerce with, you know, the shipping and returns. You know, returns are, it's real. Like the shipping of the goods to the place and then shipping it back because that's the whole model, is you're trying it on at home. I don't know what that impact is. I'm sure there are already initial kind of studies out there, but I do think it's exciting because it's breaking up the entire business structure and cost structure of how this specific industry and other industries too, but, you know, apparel, because that's my background, has kind of operated. I like the idea of direct to consumer. I like the idea of cutting out the middleman to a degree. And I also like the idea becoming a little bit more efficient with your operational processes because we're now online and we're much more plugged in with like different apps and software solutions and all that kind of stuff. There's, you know, that's a different take on sustainability, but, you know, kind of getting rid of some of the operational inefficiencies, especially in the design and product development world.
You wrote a piece about this, a short thing recently on LinkedIn that was about on-demand manufacturing and how that impacts sustainability. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah.
That seems sort of related as well.
Yeah. So that was in response to kind of Amazon patenting this on-demand kind of supply chain that they've set up. I think my point there was that we're not necessarily at a point where that's possible for garments. And I mean like the cut and sew apparel. That is possible and scalable for kind of like robotic and, you know, 3D things such as like the, you know, Adidas knit shoes or the Nike Flyknit and some specific sweaters that are all done on a machine. I think the thing with on demand, like let's say I'm, you know, I want to order this t-shirt in, you know, this color and this size, there's still a lot of steps that go into that that don't make sense unless we're talking economies of scale. So if you're going to dye the fabric, cut the t-shirt, it makes more sense to cut 100 t-shirt than it does to cut one shirt because it's the same, you know, it's the same mechanism. So that, and then having someone sew it together, that would presume that you're either batching these orders with the idea that maybe we're batching like 50 different quote unquote on-demand orders across the country and like giving it a 3-day lag and then doing it that way. I think my point there was mostly that we're technologically getting to a place that can start to really be more efficient, but on the back end, there are still considerations that are very much old school, you know, like turn of the 20th century.
Yeah. I think, I mean, in general, the not just on demand, but this also reminds me of, you know, a lot of the direct to consumer brands that are going back into the world of retail are doing it differently via things like showrooms, where they're not having inventory in their stores. They're basically just a place where you can shop and then you'll be sent the product directly.
Yep.
So it seems sort of related to that as well.
Yeah. And I think that's cool. Back to kind of the conversation of shaking things up or shaking the way things have been done, you know, in terms of operational efficiencies, you know, on the one hand, but that kind of also shakes up kind of the customer experience and again, the kind of model of what retail is, right? Like the store becomes an experience and kind of a customer loyalty builder and less of a kind of a, you know, a warehouse of your product in all sizes and colors. I think it's exciting right now where we are with that.
I was going to ask you that. Are you optimistic generally about the future? It seems so grim sometimes when you think about these topics.
It's hard, right? And it is true. Sustainability can be so dire, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of bad news out there, you know, directly impacted by every single consumption pattern and behavior that you and I have ever had, or any choice that we've ever made. But I do think there's good things happening. I do think the kind of the emphasis on experience is interesting. I don't know. I don't know exactly, you know, I'm not a sociologist, but I do think that'll have some effect on consumption long term. I mean, it's kind of the way Patagonia encourages you as a consumer not to buy more things.
Right.
Yeah, there's some kind of psychological thing happening, I presume. I hope. I'm optimistic about.
Yeah, I think I'm optimistic as well, but it's maybe more like I'm trying to be optimistic so that hopefully good things will happen and we're working towards it. Like being, because I don't think it's helpful to just sort of throw your hands up and say like, oh well, you know,
definitely,
we can't do anything about it. Let's just
just
burn it all.
Right. Yeah, because the outcome of that thought process is nihilistic in a way.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, to your broader point that things are in a lot of flux right now, I do think it's an area where there's so much happening at the same time. I don't even know if it's possible to do a study like this, but I think the shift to e-commerce has been very consumer driven. Like people want to be able to get something straight to their home because it's more convenient that way. But it's still to be determined what those trade-offs will be in the long term, because the old model was everyone drove a car to a store, which has its own inefficiencies involved with it. And the stores are these, like, there's all these big box stores, big retail stores all over America that are taking up all this space, and they're filled with inventory that maybe no one is going to buy ever. and then there's this other thing that I'm like secretly fascinated by, which is like all the self-driving car stuff. So, you know, that may have a huge impact on how our cities are laid out and how deliveries might happen back and forth. And like, so there's all these things that are happening all at the same time. And it's hard to tell, you know, when this all shakes out, like, are we left with a better supply chain in like 45 years or whatever? Because it's happening right now, it's an area where people can influence its direction.
Definitely.
More so than trying to change like an old industry that's very static.
Right. Yep.
Last question for you. Are there any books or things that you would recommend to people that have been influential for you or that just like taught you a lot that would help someone who's just starting to wrap their head around sustainability that you think are must reads
or
must
do? Well, right now I'm listening to How I Built This with Yvon Chouinard of Patagonia. I know it's old. I liked his book, Let My People Go Surfing, too, even though none of that really talks about sustainability. I think a lot of my and my business partner's kind of more pragmatic approach, you know, and FutureMade's general stance of like this thing that we're calling integrated sustainability is it being more holistic. It's almost like an attitude or kind of like a worldview of kind of what we were talking about earlier, kind of looking at the entire supply chain or the entire life cycle and just making like tweaks along the way where possible. In terms of you know, how to go about that, or like a roadmap how-to guide. I don't know that I've read that book.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate all your insights. If people want to find out more about you and about Future Made, they can go to wearefuturemade.com, send you an email or something. What would you like people to do if they have more questions about how they can make their company more sustainable?
Email tobia@wearefuturemade.com or find me on LinkedIn. Anything like that.
Cool.
Yeah. Probably no phone calls. Well, I'm weird on the phone.
it wasn't so bad for this podcast.
Well, thank you. No, I had a lot of fun. Thanks for letting me talk about this stuff.
It was great. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.